That's Jimmy McGriff and Dr. Lonnie Smith on organ, opening up on Dishing the Dirt. It's from McGriff's 2000 album, McGriff's House Party, also featuring Kenny Rampton on trumpet, Eric Alexander on tenor sax, Rodney Jones on guitar, and Bernard Purdy on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. In the second part of our program today, we'll be talking about the great Bernie Sanders proud capitulation. But first, we tackle it's a related story having to do with the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. And we're learning today that a member of Congress, Representative Marsha Blackburn, is calling for a federal investigation into the operations of the foundation, saying that it is a lawless, quote, lawless pay-to-play enterprise that has been operating under a cloak of philanthropy for years, unquote. Well, of course, we have had the extraordinary privilege of having as our guide through this labyrinth called the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Foundation, Charles Ortel, a former Wall Street investor who exposed General Electric's multi-billion dollar stock fraud in 2007-2008, and who since February last year has been examining the Clinton Foundation's labyrinth of nonprofit subsidiaries. In an exclusive series he's done with us, Mr. Ortel has charged that the Clinton Foundation is, quote, a complete and total fraud, unquote. He is with us today to discuss this burgeoning story, this developing story. And thank you, Charles, for being with us.
It's a great pleasure to be back with you, Eutrice.
Thank you so much. Well, we'll get to the fact that your name has been resurrected many times on this program, including as recently as last week when we did a special a program with Sherry Dadi. Dadi Sherry, sorry, I'm just mixing up the two names. Dadi Sherry of News Junkie Post, who was telling us about Laureate, the Laureate Education Program, of which Bill Clinton serves as honorary chair of a series of for-profit schools and universities set up by this Wall Street-backed company, and for which, as honorary chancellor, he received a payment of $16.5 million, and that has yet to be accounted for in the Clinton Foundation's reports that are required to the IRS. But let's talk about this developing story about Representative Blackburn calling on members of Congress and calling on the FBI Director James Comey, IRS Commissioner John Koskinen, and Federal Trade Commission Chairperson Edith Ramirez to begin a three-tiered, three-pronged probe of the foundation. What do you know about this?
Well, Congressman Blackburn, she actually likes to be called Congressman, is a firebrand from she represents Nashville, Tennessee. And she's deeply offended by the fact that this charity appears to have been misused and abused in ways that are grossly outside the law. And she brings the perspective of having been involved exposing what is known as the Texas Cancer Charity Fraud Case. But in reality, the Texas Cancer Charity Fraud Case encompasses, I think, two charities that were based in her home state of Tennessee. And it was a similar situation with those where a family got together and they created these charities and said they were raising money for cancer drugs to be sent around the world, but particularly to be used in Africa. And it turned out that what they were doing was raising money and spending it to support their lifestyles. So in that case, we were talking, Marsha Blackburn was talking about a $200 million, roughly $200 million fraud. This is at least 10 times bigger than that. And by the way, the $200 million fraud is the biggest to date ever disciplined. Now, the primary mechanism that is used, an important mechanism that is used to go after these types of charities, is the Federal Trade Commission. And it happens that Marsha Blackburn is the chair of a subcommittee of the House that regulates the FTC. So that's why she is taking the lead on this. And, you know, I think she and others have given up hope on the IRS. It appears to be so utterly corrupt, frankly, you know, going viciously after, in 2013, conservative and Tea Party groups, and basically allowing, it would seem, the Clintons to get away with the equivalent in the charity world of murder. She's given up, I think, on the FTC. I'm sorry, on the IRS, but nonetheless is putting them on notice with this letter. And then in addition, of course, Director Comey, you know, made his surprising decision last week on many levels. First of all, to go public with his recommendation before he had apparently tendered it to the Department of Justice. And secondly, to back off from pursuing the email national security aspects of the Clinton email case. So, Congressman Blackburn has a good staff. I actually have been in touch with members of the staff. I went down to Washington, D.C. in early June to talk to two of their staffers. But independent of me, they had been studying this. And indeed, Marsha Blackburn last year, in I think April of 2015, began her push to try to get a real incisive look at the Clinton Foundation. And then she followed it up earlier this year. I mean, I think she's done a fair amount of work, but earlier this year in May, she tried to get the FTC to do an investigation. They turned her down. And so now she's redoubling her effort.
Well, her push for a three-tiered investigation of the foundation comes on the heels of an indictment, a 24-count indictment of an African-American legislator, very popular in Florida, and that is Representative Corrine Brown, and her chief of staff both were indicted for allegedly using a charity, a charitable organization called One Door for Education Foundation, as, according to the indictment, as a slush fund that funded a number of things, frivolous expenses, including a luxury box to witness the Beyoncé performance. He had a number of other such expenditures that were charged to the fund. And it involved also soliciting over $800,000 in donations that eventually funded these frivolous expenses. Pleaded not guilty on Friday, this past Friday, to the charges, and a trial is scheduled somewhere down the road. But what is significant about this is that we have a push here to convict someone for exactly the same charges that have been hounding the Clintons and the foundation for many years now, and we've seen no push at all against them. Do you find that interesting?
I find it fascinating, and indeed, so does Marsha Blackburn. I mean, here's a case, I don't know the particulars of Congresswoman Brown's case. I have read, I skimmed the indictment, which was unsealed on Friday. And if you believe the charges of the indictment, there are some issues, significant issues. And if they are proven, then I'm afraid that Congressman Brown is in for some rough sledding. I mean, the U.S. attorney, I believe, in this case, obviously with the understanding of Loretta Lynch, in a case this high profile, is seeking, made known that if Congressman Brown's convicted, that she faces over 350 years in prison. Now, that seems a little harsh for a sitting congressperson who's been representing her district, I think, since 93, and an amount of only $800,000. Because when you contrast that to the Clintons, the Clintons have declared incoming receipts of $2.1 billion. They've never had an audit for this foundation that's compliant with the rules, and I'm very sure of that. The rules are called SFAS 117 is a very detailed set of guidelines promulgated in 1993. They call for strict accounting of charities of this size, and they've never gotten strict accounting. The accounts that are out there in the public domain are riddled with inconsistencies and errors and multiple red flags for fraud. And, you know, $2 billion over the course of, let's say, 19, let's call it 20 years, although it's shorter. Yeah, that's $100 million a year. And here we're talking about $800,000 over the life of her charity. So it does seem to me to be a double standard, inexplicably so, when you consider that Loretta Lynch, if she did have anything to say here, you know, must know that there's been a hue and cry over the foundation. So why do you let U.S. attorneys pounce on this congressman in the middle of her district has been redistricted and she has a special election. You know, why do you do this now in July of 2016 and then sit on so many levels the Clinton Foundation? It just does not seem remotely fair and equitable. It's the type of, you know, here it's on the left, you know, an inconsistency, but it's a kind of inconsistency that should not occur in the United States of America 2016. If we believe in anything in this country, whether we're progressive or conservative or whatever, we believe, I think, in equal treatment under law. And that's not what I see here. And, you know, quite frankly, you know, I'm not probably a huge political supporter of the Florida congressman, but, you know, nonetheless, I think that this is outrageous, and I'm glad you're bringing it up.
Well, what was interesting was that the last time I saw Corrine Brown was in a photograph of her coming off of Air Force One, being assisted by President Obama. She was, of course, stumping for the Democratic Party and for Hillary Clinton, who also is a staunch supporter, supposedly, of Congresswoman Brown. Also, we have this the irony here of Congresswoman Brown, who, again, is a very staunch supporter of the Democratic Party, very popular in Jacksonville, especially Florida. And yes, her district has been redistricted, and there is this rumor that many senior members, especially of the African-American group in Congress, are being targeted because the Republicans see an opportunity with the groundswell of support for Donald Trump to retake many districts, and they're doing this by redistricting and by just plain targeting these districts for the Republican candidate. Marsha Blackburn is a Republican from Tennessee, and she is making this push against Clinton. How do you read this?
Well, I know that she's deeply offended that a former president would do what it appears this president has done. I mean, we are not talking in former President Clinton. We're not talking about somebody with no experience in the law. We're talking about a Rhodes Scholar. We're talking about a graduate of Yale Law School and his wife as well. Very difficult to get into those schools. And then we're talking about the former Attorney General of Arkansas, the former governor of Arkansas, the former president of the United States. This is not somebody who has the excuse that he doesn't understand, nor does Hillary have the excuse that she doesn't understand the law. And the law is really strict. When the president, former president, put together his foundation starting October 23, 1997, the paperwork that was filed that is in the public domain and it should be in the public domain shows categorically that foundation was just meant to be a repository in Little Rock, Arkansas, for his archives and records, where people could also study those archives and records once the repository was erected. That's all it was meant to be. Now, we all understand IRS forms, and they're lengthy and complicated, but with a foundation, a public charity, you're asked by the IRS to list out specifically what activity codes you intend to follow, and there's only one for international, code 910. And they did not select that code, nor did they ever amend the purposes of this foundation to act internationally. The codes that were selected are consistent with the language in the application that's on file called the Form 1023. They're consistent with the articles of incorporation. Again, those are on file on the Clinton Foundation site as well as in numerous states. It is abundantly clear that this foundation was just meant to be a Little Rock-based repository. So when you when you couple the fact that very early on, starting in January 26, 2001, when there was an earthquake in India, Bill Clinton started running around the world soliciting money in the name of the Clinton Foundation for international activities for which the Clinton Foundation was not authorized. That's a serious set of offenses in every state, particularly in New York State where he did it. He's proof that he did it. It's a serious offense to do that, to raise money, tell donors that the money that they are contributing might be deducted against their personal income tax return when the foundation was never authorized for that purpose. So it's a problem in federal level. It's a problem at state level. And it's also a problem when you think about it, you know, that we have rivals around the world, whether it be Vladimir Putin or the Chinese leadership. Many countries are suspicious about, and it would seem, looking at the Clinton case with reason, they're suspicious about what our charities really do around the world. And I happen to believe, whether the charities are right-leaning or left-leaning or whatever, that American charities, on balance, are a force for good. So when we have the former president of the United States swanning around the world, and he's not flying coach, by the way, you know, in private planes and living it up in big presidentialist suites, you know, he shouldn't be doing that unless the foundation is actually authorized for the purposes it claims it's pursuing. Moreover, when you account for an international operation, as I have done, it is extremely complicated because you have currencies moving around. You have, you know, it's tough to keep track and segregate expenses as among, you know, many different countries where you're doing operations. It's tough to do that work properly. So when you set about that work, you should hire an accountant that's competent to do this work. And instead they hired an awful firm called D as in boy, K as in king, D as in dog. You look that firm up, there have been some articles written recently about it. It's a very questionable firm that's had a lot of problems and has, you know, little to no direct control over international activity, so little to no ability to actually check what was in fact going on around the world. So, you know, this is a case, I think it is a massive governance failure. It is a case study in fraud, in charity fraud. It is something that Marsha Blackburn is absolutely right to try to instigate. And quite frankly, this is a case where I would hope Democrats would join with Marsha Blackburn, recognizing she, you know, she is conservative socially, but on this issue, maybe we could park that and we could agree that, you know, if we're going to set up presidential foundations and international foundations, they ought to be regulated properly.
Well, it is curious also that what Blackburn is seeking, from what I understand, this public corruption probe that she's seeking that would involve the IRS, the FBI, and the Federal Trade Commission, she is asking, as part of her request, that they look at the relationships between the big money donors to the foundation and U.S. foreign policy decisions that were made when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Why is that, do you think? Why does she align those two?
Well, you know, the Secretary of State has, as we all understand, a large ability to influence who gains from U.S. government activity. And there's really two major ways in which, maybe more than two, but two that I can think of. The first is, as regards U.S. donors to the Clinton Foundation, there are many multinational companies that are trying to get, you know, the cover of the U.S. government to promote their international activities. So there, Boeing is an important one, and of course that's America's leading export around the world in competition with Airbus and other players. You know, if you have the support of the American government as Boeing in a competition to sell aircraft to one or more developing countries, that's a big lever up. So you're real happy to give small money from the Boeing firms, you know, $1 million, $5 million, $10 million. You're real happy to do that if it gets you a gigantic multi-billion-dollar plane order. And, you know, you can say that that's the way things have always been done, but that doesn't make it right. And, you know, GE is a big donor. Monsanto is a big donor. There's a bunch of other multinationals. So that's on U.S. outward work that a donor for the Clinton Foundation might get a benefit. The other way is, of course, these foreign governments. And, you know, foreign governments are very anxious either to be on our nice list or off our bad list. And so if you can have potentates give money into the Clinton Foundation and then have the Clinton Foundation go nice, I mean, sorry, the Obama administration go nice against the Myanmar or Qatar or Saudi Arabia or you name it. Then beyond that, I suppose the third way is Clinton Foundation donors, you know, particularly those who go to what I would argue is another fraud, the Clinton Global Initiative, that is obviously not a charity. It's just a clearinghouse where favors are exchanged for contributions. You know, when you look closely at it, if you consult with charity legal experts, you'll see what I'm talking about. It has no charitable purpose within the meaning of the law. That annual meeting is a place where big donors can hobnob with the leaders and former leaders of countries around the world that can dole out concessions, be they mining concessions, energy concessions, telecom concessions, etc. So I think Marshall Blackburn is absolutely right to force, particularly given the absence of any kind of accounting controls over this thing, and the huge discrepancies between what donors have claimed publicly to have given to the Clinton Foundation versus what the Clinton books tell us that the Clinton Foundation is declaring. For all these reasons, I think it is time to have a serious look at what governments have given what money to the Clinton Foundation since its inception. You know, Yatrice, that for all the hue and cry of all the, you know, the recent pronouncements of the Clinton, that, you know, they're all above board and the redoing of the books that happened last year in November, the Clinton Foundation issued a cumulative disclosure list of its donations on December 18th, 2008. Around the same time, they filed their return to 2007. They never filed a return for 1997, the partial year when they first started. But for 1998 through 2007, in no return that has been filed, did they declare one penny of government donation. Yet, on December 18th, 2008, they provide this cumulative list that has tens of millions of dollars coming from certain governments, and it doesn't make any sense. There's no robust disclosure for 2008 audit. So on its face, the Clinton Foundation books have been phony and riddled with errors purposefully ever since 2009, I would argue, to disguise the fact of how much money was sent towards the Clinton Foundation by these governments and how much money has actually landed on the books. And I can tell you, if the name of this foundation were the Bush Foundation or, you know, even the Ortel Foundation, there were these types of discrepancies, we would be in the midst, we would have been in an unbelievable set of, you know, years-long audits, painstaking, you know, dentist-style, tooth-drilling investigation of this mess. Instead, the Clinton get a pass.
Dottie Sherry was with us, and she outlined in this splendid article that she did. I recommend that people read it. It's on News Junkie Post. And she talks about this for-profit education giant named Laureate Education, how it was formed, backed by hedge fund investors on Wall Street, and how in an extraordinarily short time, it became not only immensely profitable, but also involved the participation of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Bill Clinton getting $16.5 million was named honorary chairman of this for-profit enterprise, and it became instantly global, and the story tells about how this operation basically makes its profits by putting students into debt. And the reason we did the program was just a day prior, Hillary Clinton adopting a portion of Bernie Sanders' platform as a concession for his support, talked about her commitment to debt-free education. But a Laureate Education, you have been studying the files of the Clinton Foundation since February last year. Has it popped up in your scope as an enterprise, one of those many enterprises that require very close review, both in terms of how it operated, but more so how the Clintons and their foundation operated?
Absolutely. I spoke at length to Dottie about this. The laureate story, actually, if I may correct you, it's not a story of profit. It's a Ponzi scheme. So what they have done is the idea behind laureate is to create, and they have created, the largest string around the world of for-profit universities. Now, every time, I was in the business of making these types of investments, working for other people and with other people. And you know, when you do this type of thing, what you do, if you do it correctly, is you say, you know, let's forget the specifics of laureate. Let's understand the industry first. How does this industry work? Who are the players in the industry? Well, the players in the university industry, if you want to call it that, around the world, are principally government-backed and/or private entities that do not seek a profit. So that means that, you know, when they operate these schools, you know, your competitors aren't looking for the profit. And many of them, if you talk about, you know, the big university systems in this country and around the world, they're very, very financially solvent. They have, you know, great campuses, and they're the best students in the world compete to get into these places. So, you know, what are you left with as laureate? You're left with a middle ground of people who, for whatever reason, either didn't get into the top schools or choose not to go to the top schools. And now what you're telling your investors is you're going to make a profit off this second-tier group. Now, we can debate whether that's a moral thing to do. The second-tier group is going to be competing against the top-tier group. Maybe, you know, some of them will be hungrier. Maybe they're going to do better. But is it really sensible to saddle the second-tier group with subprime loans? And, you know, and these are not cheap places. In order to make a profit, laureate charges top dollar. So, you know, the first instance is I would argue that the team that got together that backed the internal management, Doug Becker is the name of the CEO, and his the co-founders of laureate, back in the 2006-2007 timeframe, should be ashamed of themselves. We're talking here about Paul Allen. We're talking about Henry Kravis. We're talking about Stevie Cohen. We're talking about very shrewd people who are billionaires in many cases, most cases. Who give money to the not-for-profit educational world, who should know better. But, you know, back, if we can remember back 2006-2007, that was just the crest of the last bubble. That was when people, a lot of stupid deals got done, and I would argue this laureate deal was one of them. So it got done, and then the world fell apart financially. And so that's why I say, Yatrice, in the beginning, laureate actually didn't do that well. So to cover itself up, I would argue, to put, you know, nice, pretty wrapping paper on it, they reached out to Bill Clinton, and by April of 2010, he, when Hillary was Secretary of State, signed on to this gravy train. I mean, he was being paid. You have to remember the sum of $16.5 million that he got over the five-year period, 2010 to 2014, was for part-time work. So that's like $3.3 million a year for part-time work, and we don't know exactly what that means, whether it's half a year, a week a year, 3 days a year, we don't know yet. In addition, the second piece of this puzzle is that many of the capital suppliers, the Goldman Sachs was an important capital supplier, and other banks, investment firms, paid the Clintons personally a large speaking fees, which are not part of that $16.5 million, as far as I know. So, you know, here they paid Bill a lot of money. Hillary doesn't disclose this until after she leaves her role as Secretary of State, and they march along, and they try to take the thing public in 2012. Now, the way I used to work in this sphere, what you're trying to do when you come in and you close the deal August 2007, you definitely want to sell out as an investor, you know, within 2.5-3 years. So by 2012, they hadn't sold out. They tried to do an initial public offering. They failed. And in January of 2013, while Hillary was leaving, the International Finance Corporation, over which the World Bank and Hillary and the Secretary of State will have influence, made the largest single investment that the International Finance Corporation has ever made, $200 million between the IFC, a fund controlled by the IFC, and the Korean Sovereign Wealth Fund, put $200 million into laureate. Now, that certainly, to me, looks like a quid pro quo. And I asked myself, you know, why would the International Finance Corporation choose, of all entities in the world, to make its largest ever historic investment in laureate? It doesn't make sense. And wouldn't you know that when you look through the finances, which are now public, because they're trying to take the thing public yet again, actually to sell out the piece that the Koreans bought, in part, wouldn't you know that the financial fortunes of Laureate have just plummeted? It's their profits have evaporated. They've lost almost $1 billion since 2013. The finances are actually horrible. So, you know, this is one case. This entity is based in Baltimore, on top of which, I think it's USAID, while Hillary was Secretary of State, made a decision to send $55 million to a charity that Doug Becker, the CEO of Laureate, was involved with, called the International Youth Foundation. So, I mean, that's just one case that cries out. I mean, you know, we shouldn't be using foundations as clearinghouses to tap into multilateral pools of money using political influence. That is not what you're supposed to do in a charity. And in fact, the rules in charities are really, really strict. You cannot operate a charity for private gain. Ordinarily, the IRS would look at this and say, now, wait a minute. You know, the amount of private gain that's being created through the operation of the charity is potentially in the many tens of billions of dollars. That is clearly substantial in relation to the supposed charitable activity of this foundation. We need to shut this thing down. We need to find the people who are trustees. And the fine, you know, when you look at what's a technical term called enormous, when trustees of a foundation or people close to senior positions in the foundation, people who can exercise influence over the foundation, derive a private gain, that's called enormous. And the penalties for that are severe.
But, you know, if the IRS were to take action here, there would be hell to pay politically, because one assumes that's why the head of the IRS at the time, Louis Lerner, was an appointee of the Clintons, in a way, in the Democratic Party. There's no interest, especially in a highly contested presidential election year, to have the party, in effect, be seen as attacking itself. So who could be counted on to do independent work that would focus on the legalities and the illegalities committed here, and to basically take action against individuals who were the principals in this Ponzi scheme, as you call it?
Well, you see, here's the way I would look at this. You know, I think, and I think you as well, and your listeners, when we think about this, will reject the notion that the way politics, the election should work, is that the winning political party gets to do whatever it wants, damn the rules. And that's a very dangerous precedent to set. I don't think it happened. I mean, there certainly were excesses in the time period when George W. Bush was president, the House and Senate were controlled by Republicans. But, you know, I wouldn't argue back then, as bad as some decisions were, that it was a case where, you know, Republicans won no matter what, people committed crimes and got away with it, and, you know, that was just the way it worked. If we want to go to this zone, where, you know, if the Democratic Party has the presidency, the House, and the Senate, which it would only have briefly this time, then Democrats get to do whatever they want. They get to, you know, if we want to go down that track, we need to be very careful and think through, you know, there's a possibility, Democrats might not want to admit it, but there is a possibility that come election time this year that a Republican wins the presidency and that the Republicans retain control of the House and the Senate. Do you really want to have that precedent set? And I would argue, no, I don't want to. As somebody who might more likely vote for a Republican than a Democrat, I think the clear precedent needs to be set with this case. This is such an egregious case. This is not a case of people, you know, who didn't know the rules. This is not the case, as in the case of Corinne Brown, that's only a few years. This is going on 2 decades just with this one, the Clinton Foundation. 2 decades of rampant, escalating abuse around the world. And I think, you know, Americans would be doing the not-for-profit sector a service, making it a case study example of this, mounting a bipartisan, in-depth, incisive investigation of the Clinton Foundation and all of its affiliates, and there are many of them, and look at the records, expose the records, think about what happened here, if there are transgressions, punish them. Punish those responsible severely. I mean, remember, the U.S. attorney in Jacksonville or Florida is asking to put Corinne Brown in prison for 350 years over $800,000. Now, frankly, I think that acts of the kind of excessive sentences, you know, that have happened in the past, and I think it's, you know, it's excessive. But, you know, I really do think in this case that, you know, if it is the case, if it can be proven that this foundation, in fact, never was supposed to do any international work, and if it is the case, as I believe it is, they've never had an audit, and if it's the case that they've never had truly independent trustees, who's responsible for all this? And the people who are responsible should be punished financially. You know, I'm not a huge fan of putting former presidents in jail. I think that's a dangerous thing to do. But I think short of that, all those responsible, you know, for this should be severely punished and have to make financial restitution to their donors. And the full truth should be told so that, you know, people will understand that this is an example of what you do not do when you set out to run a charity.
What, since the last time we talked, what have you been concentrating on in terms of other revelations about the operations of the Clinton Foundation?
Well, I've been digging ever more deeply into the state and federal filings. I found many more cases. You know, when a foundation is big, typically it would need to register in most every state where you can register. It's about 46 of them, I think, out of 50. And so I've spent a lot of time looking through historical state filings. I found abundant proof that this thing was never authorized to do international work and that the trustees, you know, knew that because individual trustees under penalties of state perjury in states like Minnesota, Massachusetts, and New York did make filings in which they stated categorically that this was to be a Little Rock-based archive and research facility. So that's one thing. Another thing I found out, you know, and it is, to lay this whole thing out is going to take really hundreds of pages, and I'm working on all that. And you really have to go through from the very beginning, October 23, 1997, understand what was going on back then. You got to get into some tawdry business. I don't want to really dwell on all that stuff involving the whiskey and all that. But, you know, when you go way back into this, you start at the beginning, what you find is that with the Clintons, the recent email scandal involving, you know, recent history is not the first time that a lot of emails went missing. In 1996, there were rumors that the Clinton administration was using the White House and executive branch assets to raise money for the 1996 campaign, presidential and otherwise. And in the course of that, there was an investigation. What do you know? Emails went missing back, even back then, but not just a few of them. So you have to place this in context. You have to understand, you know, who were the people who were allegedly funneling money illegally to the expense trust, the first one that was set up, the Charlie Tree gentleman and other foreign people with connections to foreign links. So what happened in 1998? A second trust was formed. And that trust, as it turns out, was led by a trustee of the Clinton Foundation. Indeed, that other second trust, former Senator David Pryor, was the chairman of it. And the Clintons have attempted to hide that fact in their filings that are on their website. The 1998 list of trustees is purposefully excluded from the filing, but of course I was able to find it in state filings, and of course David Pryor, the chairman of the expense trust thing, is in numerous New York Times articles being quoted as having raised hundreds, if not thousands, of contributions. Wouldn't you know that in 1998 the Clinton Foundation implausibly claimed that they only raised three contributions, three, which makes no sense.
Well, lying, or should I say misrepresenting the truth, is a major skill of both the Clintons. Charles, I want to thank you for joining us today and telling us even more in this ongoing series about the functioning of the Clinton Foundation and the questions that surround it. Thank you so much for being with us. And to let people know, how could folks keep abreast of the things that you're discussing? You have a website. You want to let us know about that?
Thank you, Yatriz. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, there are two ways. One is my site, which is creatively my name, www.charlesortel.com. And then also on Twitter, I try to do a decent job of tweeting out every day what I'm up to and thinking about and what I think is important to follow, particularly in this area. And that's my name again, uppercase C, uppercase O, at Charles Ortel.
Well, thanks again, and we'll be talking soon as more things develop with respect to the Clintons and their foundation. All right. Well, it has happened. We warned you. We told you it was coming, and we did so quite a ways back, if you recall, and that was that Bernie Sanders will cave to Hillary and the Democratic Party. Here's what happened yesterday. Okay, we don't have the clip. Okay, well, yesterday I wanted to share with you the clip of Bernie Sanders capitulating. Okay, so here we go. We have it now.
Secretary Clinton has won the Democratic nominating process, and I congratulate her for that. She will be the Democratic nominee for president. And I intend to do everything I can to make certain she will be the next president of the United States. I have come here to make it as clear as possible as to why I am endorsing Hillary Clinton and why she must become our next president. Hillary Clinton understands that if someone in America works 40 hours a week, that person should not be living in poverty. She believes, we all believe, that we must raise the minimum wage to a living wage. But her opponent, Donald Trump, well, he has a very different view. He believes that states should have the right to lower the minimum wage or even abolish the concept of the minimum wage. If Donald Trump is elected, we will see no increase in the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, a starvation wage. This election is about who will appoint new justices on the Supreme Court, who will defend a woman's right to choose, who will defend the rights of the LGBT community, who will defend workers' rights, the needs of minorities and immigrants, and the government's ability to protect our environment. Hillary Clinton wants to see that all Americans have the right to choose a public option in their health care exchange, which will lower the cost of health care for millions. And what is Donald Trump's position on health care? Well, no surprise there. Same old Republican contempt for working families. He wants to abolish the Affordable Care Act, throw 20 million people off of the health insurance they currently have and cut Medicaid for low-income Americans. While Hillary Clinton supports making our tax code fairer and more progressive, Donald Trump wants to give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the very wealthiest people in this country. His reckless economic policies will not only exacerbate income and wealth inequality, they will increase our national debt by trillions of dollars. While Donald Trump is busy insulting Mexicans and Muslims and women and African Americans and our veterans, Hillary Clinton understands that our diversity is one of our greatest strengths. Hillary Clinton will make an outstanding president, and I am proud to stand with her today.
Okay. Well, it's embarrassing, actually. And I felt kind of sorry watching Bernie Sanders become so enthusiastic and so convinced before this major crowd witnessing this meltdown, this capitulation to Hillary Clinton and more so to the Democratic Party, after garnering in excess of 13 million votes from people who were thinking they were making an investment into an independent process, an independent party, and an investment in a person who would see the course through. That didn't happen. But we predicted that. You see, just yesterday I talked about if you have clarity about things, none of this surprises you. We predicted this is what was going to happen from the very beginning. This is what's going to happen. Why? Because it's a system. And systems rarely depart from their mode of operation. They rarely do. Why? Because systems are scientifically designed to remain just the way they are, because the concept of a system is survival. And they scientifically designed themselves to maintain the possibility, the very real possibility of survival over everybody else. So you didn't have to ask, well, is Bernie Sanders going to end up supporting the Democratic Party? Absolutely, yes. He was going to, because that's the way we talked about Sanders as being, you know, the latest incarnation of capitulators. We saw Jesse Jackson do it. We saw Dennis Kucinich do it. We saw Barack Obama do it. And now comes Bernie Sanders. So this is not news. Okay, it is not a surprise. What we were hoping for, and still am hoping, I still am hoping for it, is that those 13 million people who voted for Bernie Sanders will also be very circumspect about those votes in the future, as in the general election. And what needs to happen to break the cycle of betrayal, it seems to me, what seems to happen is something I've been advocating for years. Number one, you make it clear in the beginning what you are expecting of the candidate that you're going to invest in. That in this sense, Bernie represented that this was going to be a people's movement and in the end made a personal choice. He didn't ask permission from his constituency whether this is something he should do. He just went ahead and did it. Because in the end, he regarded these votes, these 13 million plus votes, as his personal property to do with whatever he chooses to do. And he probably has calculated that he has to go back to the Senate. And chances are he could go back to the Senate as a more powerful and influential person, as opposed to being in the minority of one as an independent, as socialist Democrat. That might have played a factor in things. But either way, I don't recall that Bernie sent out a poll, a form, or some kind of an information pamphlet asking his group, what do they think he ought to do? He made a decision. And the expectation is this personal decision that he made would fly with his constituency. He arrogated unto himself the power of his people. That's an interesting thing. In any way, we see it as not being very different from the way the system operates. He just adopted its style, and creating this new crazy reality. We know that it isn't true. It doesn't fit the political profile and history either of Hillary Clinton or the Democratic Party, the sudden identification with the people, no. The party's first and most important identification has been with itself and its survival. And we should, those people who supported Sanders, those who felt the burn, should remember that they felt the Democratic burn first. 8 years of not very much progress. So when we read into Bernie Sanders' capitulation, what we see is that he has fulfilled the mission. And this is, in my view, a betrayal. Never mind all these wonderful words that he said. It's a betrayal. And it is the unilateral arrogation to himself, not to his constituents. He did not ask his supporters what they thought or what they think about this or what they want to do or what they would have him do. He reverted to the basic political democratic hack way of operating, which is these are my votes. I could do with them whatever it is I want to do. It's disappointing, but it is not at all, it's not surprising. This is, after all, politics. Even though professed by a person who says he's independent and a democratic socialist and all of this. Now, the real point I want to make here is that it should cause, again, this is a lesson to be learned. This is not the first time we've seen this kind of betrayal. And there ought to be a change in the way people operate. You do not invest in a candidate until it is clear that that candidate understands that he or she is a mere vehicle for the aggregate views, the aggregate program of the constituents. You're just a vehicle. You're not the owner of these votes. You're not the owner of this movement. So they should get that clear real fast, real soon. Secondly, there is no reason to believe that simply because Bernie Sanders has capitulated that they need to do the same. No. If you are convinced that the political choice you made to be independent of this duopoly, continue it. And plan on doing so. Thirdly, punishment is due. You see, I believe in that. When your political people disappoint you and betray you, you have to punish them. You have to punish this party. This party deserves to be punished, completely punished. You reject it. You publicly reject it. And you work simultaneously on another track, which is to build your own. So it's not the end. Maybe this had to happen to again prove the merit of the argument that you got to do something different. Once you attain clarity, you have clarity. You don't need to do this the fifth time. We don't need a fifth experience. Bernie is experience number four. Leave it at that. And say, well, okay, four times, we get it. We really do get it. We're moving in a different direction after this. And begin the process of constructing what comes after this. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. We learned a lot. This Clinton Foundation and its shenanigans, it is mind-boggling that the Clintons have been able to get away with these atrocities, and they have come through unscathed. And it's clear, it's because they have a system, a support system that is almost foolproof, that is so, it remains intact, and it is effective. Hillary Clinton, to my view, is not at all worthy of consideration for election to dog catcher. But there she is. She is likely to be the next president. And it has nothing to do with her capability and her special talents and her brilliance and her patriotism, and none of that. It has to do with the fact that she has a support system that can deliver exactly what she wants. It's organized that way. That's what politics is. Most of the people who present themselves as candidates for leadership of the country, I mean, if the world were fair, more than half of them would just be set aside as completely unworthy of consideration. But they have systems that could launch them into political orbit and keep them there. I thank you for joining me. As I said before, I always feel privileged to be in your company. You can reach me always at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and I thank you. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.